Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Topp. I lost 135 pounds and drastically improved my whole family's health adopting a paleo lifestyle. My husband Matt, who happens to be the producer of this podcast, and I blog our recipes, successes, and struggles at paleoparents.com. Matt and I have authored two cookbooks, Eat Like a Dinosaur, a family-friendly recipe and guidebook for kids, and the upcoming Beyond Bacon, which is a paleo recipe book respecting the whole hog, nose to tail, due out in hardback July 2nd, 2013. We have a passion for family-friendly meals that are practical, affordable, and sustainable to the earth, as well as our long-term health.
And I'm Sarah Ballantyne. I was a scientist before becoming a full-time stay-at-home mom and the blogger behind thepaleomom.com. I'm also the author of the upcoming book, The Paleo Approach, available for pre-order now off Amazon and due out September 28th, 2013. Both my blog and The Paleo Approach are heavily focused on the autoimmune protocol. I also blog about the practical application of the paleo diet and share wonderful recipes.
Next up, news and views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip.
Hello.
Hey.
How are you?
I just stepped in like 18 Legos on my way to the computer. If you
those hurt.
Yeah. I think it's like my fate as the mother of three boys to forever be in pain as I try to walk across my house.
You know what? As the mother of two girls and also two girls who have an extensive Lego collection and Tinker Toys, which also I'm not very fond of stepping on. And Polly Pockets, which you may not have that many of, but those also don't feel that good to step on.
Yeah.
I can say it's just dangerous being a parent and having feet.
Indeed. Although probably dangerous to, well,
it's,
anyway.
It's, yeah. I mean, I guess if you want to do the barefoot thing, which, you know, we know thanks to Mark Sisson that we're supposed to do. Speaking of Mark Sisson, guess who is wearing some amber-tinted glasses right now?
You're the biggest geek I know. In an adorable way. Although, did you see that Nom Nom Paleo was wearing sunglasses during the day for the opposite effect? Because she works at night. And I was like, have you guys been talking? Honestly. Geeks of the world are uniting.
You know what? Nom Nom and I are like, we're like psychically connected, I'm pretty sure. So, yeah, I should send her a message and be like, rock on, sister. Yeah. No, for me, it's because I really, my lifestyle is so different. Writing the gargantuan encyclopedic book that I seem to be writing. I don't know what I was thinking. I'm at that point now where I'm like, what was I thinking? I love what I've written, but it's just getting to be so big. And I can't stop because I've gone into this detail, you know, so far for such a huge portion of the book. Like, I can't just then, like, phone it in for the rest. So I'm at this point where
I'm pretty sure you wouldn't be phoning it in any case, but go ahead.
But my lifestyle is so different because of all of that time that I've had to create to write that I'm trying to find ways to not burn out. Or at least, you know, if I do burn out, not burn out so badly that I can't recover quickly. So the whole like protecting my melatonin production kind of makes sense to me. But someone shared on my Facebook wall the SHIT people say YouTube series. Do you know that YouTube series?
No.
It's like a series of, there's hundreds of different YouTube videos that's like, this one is SHIT that paleo people say.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I laughed so hard.
I think someone put that on my wall and I haven't watched it yet.
It's amusing. Especially my favorite part was where the guy is drinking the juice from the bottom of a Bubby's sauerkraut guitar. He's like, it's good. I just, I lost it. It was just too funny for me.
I think it's adorable that you spelled that word as if, like, my 7-year-old listening to the podcast wouldn't know what you just spelled.
But how was I supposed to say it without spelling it and then without, like, not, I didn't want to say it.
I don't know. I just think it's adorable.
And throw in, like, a little bleep when he's editing. Because that's not, like, too much work. You can, you know, like, one of those, like...
Let's not make more work for Matt. He might actually strangle me. Because our book is supposed to be finished this week. And my grandfather is very ill. And so I've been spending, like, every free moment that I have with him and my family. And I also, like, had an offsite at work last week. So I literally, like, did not come home for essentially the entire week that our book is due. And so our job, this podcast, is to not require any editing at all, including the elephant stomping above me, if you heard that. That's going to stay in.
I did not hear elephant stomping, so yay. and if anyone else did, as they're listening to this podcast, and was like, Sarah, you just weren't paying attention. Well, it's possible.
So I had this, we had a Beyond Bacon recipe testers potluck yesterday, which is quite a mouthful, but, so like basically all of our recipe testers who were local were invited to come over and bring a dish that they tested. And then we all got to eat like a spread of Beyond Bacon. I've never seen food disappear so quickly in my life, by the way. Like, honestly, we have these potlucks all the time, and we usually have the added bonus after hosting of having a bunch of leftovers. And like 3/4 of the way through the party, there were people who still didn't like get any food at all. And they were like elbowing other people who were going back for seconds for food because it disappeared that quickly. Anyway,
that's a good sign.
It was a good sign. I was kind of worried that, you know, there would be too much pork, but evidently there is no such thing.
There's no such thing. I have to say, being the proud owner of slightly less than half a pig, because we've eaten some, I'm not tired of it yet. I, like, every once in a while I'll make, like, a different kind of meat for my family so that they can have a break. And then the next time we have pork, everyone's like, oh, this is the best pork.
It is.
So,
It took me 3 months. 3 months of nothing but lard and pork before I finally was like, can we get some chicken up in here? Like, okay. So, but the point that I was going to say is that while we had this meetup, there was friends of ours. And although I'm friends with the husband, like, I'm much closer friends with the wife. And so it's not as though I'm like familiar with his everyday habits. Turns out he listens to the paleo podcasts, including ours, which I don't know why, but it always surprises me when men listen to the show. So wherever you are, fist pump. Like, it's awesome that you're listening, because
to all the men out there.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Can we pull a Rob Wolf joke and say all 6 of them?
Yeah. Bonus points, gold stars, all around. Awesome. But the reason that I found this out is because he looked at me with such, like, genuineness that I knew he wasn't being sarcastic, because he and I are often sarcastic with one another. And he was like, your interview with Mark Sisson last week was the best interview that I've heard with Mark Sisson. And he, like, named all of the things that he'd listened to with Mark Sisson. And he was like, honestly and sincerely, your interview was so great. And I was
that's so sweet.
So I just wanted to share that with you.
Thank
because
you.
People don't know this, but you actually booked Mark for the show. Usually I'm the person that booked.
It was this crazy, I realized I had a contact and I just said, hey, does Mark want to be on the show? And then they said yes. And I went, whoa. I don't know if people realize this. I mean, I can certainly hear it in my own voice. I was so freaking nervous.
I could tell. It was so cute.
I was so like, oh my gosh, I'm talking with Mark Sisson and I don't want to make a fool of myself.
You were giggly. You were a giggly, geeky school girl. It was adorable.
Yeah, totally. Totally. But he was such a pro. Like, he totally made me feel at ease. And then every once in a while, it would occur to me that I was talking to Mark Sisson, and then I would feel nervous again. But it was awesome. I loved last week's show. I mean, I love every show, but, like, yeah.
Yes. So it was exciting for you because mm-hmm. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was the first guest that you had booked for the show. Cause usually I'm the one that's like, hey, you come on our show.
I kind of, well, especially because, my blog has grown pretty dramatically since then. I haven't met anybody. I haven't even met you. Everybody, Stacy and I have never met. Like, how crazy is that? But, like, I haven't met anybody, so I don't feel like I know anybody. So it was always kind of like, oh, Stacy, you know everybody. Like, you do that job.
I don't actually know people. I just, if you walk around with enough confidence, eventually other people believe it too. No.
The next 2 weeks are guests that I booked.
Yeah. This time.
So I'm
mostly because I've kind of just fallen off the face of the earth the last couple of weeks. And Sarah's like, what do you want to do? I'm like, I don't know. I might be able to show up. So,
book excuse is an awfully good excuse. Plus, you know, grandfather not doing well, like totally icing on the cake. So,
yeah. So
I don't mind at all because I totally know you're going to be doing this the first couple of weeks of May when I'm in frantic get my book done mode as well.
Yep.
Right. Right.
For
right?
sure. I will do a much less awesome job, but I will do my best.
So you're saying I can phone it in?
Yeah. Or just if you're saying I'm phoning it in.
No, I'm not.
Okay. I think we should probably get to a show because we both have a lot to do and you're wearing melatonin inducing amber tinted glasses and I don't want you to fall asleep halfway through.
But I am not drinking Natural Calm. So I don't have the double whammy. I'm drinking ginger tea instead. So
if you put Beauty Balm on your face, that's it. You'd be out.
Although I did already. No, I did.
Uh-oh.
I am in my pajamas. Full disclosure. I'm in my pajamas most weeks when we record.
I love that you just almost said jammies.
Jammies, I know. Or Jimmy Jams or Capujays is the other one that my kids call them. I don't.
You are sincerely one of the most adorable geeks ever. All right.
It's a good thing.
Do you want to geek out about something other than pajamas right now?
Let's do a Science with Sarah.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
Science. So today's show is about immune disorders, and I thought it might be important to sort of differentiate what an immune disorder is from an autoimmune disorder, because we talk about autoimmune disease quite frequently on this show because Stace and I both have autoimmune disease and are both on the autoimmune protocol. So it's something we get a lot of questions about.
Or modified
autoimmune protocol or recovering autoimmune protocol. But I thought it would be really a good idea to just briefly explain what the difference is. So in both immune disorders, and an example of an immune disorder might be asthma or allergies or eczema, which often actually gets tagged as an autoimmune disorder, but it's actually an immune disorder. Autoimmune diseases would be things like celiac disease, type 1 diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, lupus. So the difference between an immune disorder and autoimmune disorder is the target. So an immune disorder is still a dysfunctional immune system. The immune system is not working properly. Some people say it's where the immune system no longer has the ability to defend your body. In many cases, it's still an overactive immune system. In an autoimmune disease, that's still happening. It's still a dysfunctional immune system. It's still an overactive and overstimulated immune system, but it's also an immune system that's lost the ability to distinguish self from foreign invader. So in an autoimmune disease, you have this dysfunctional, overactive immune system, but it is also targeting proteins within your body. In an immune disorder like allergies or asthma, the immune system's not specifically targeting any proteins or cells or tissues in your body. It just happens to be causing damage, but it's very generalized and dispersed. And so it's not that targeted attack that autoimmune disease. And that is really the only thing that separates those two like broad umbrella classes of diseases. Immune disorders have a dysfunctional immune system. Autoimmune disorders have a dysfunctional immune system that's also attacking self. So one of the questions that I get asked very frequently is the autoimmune protocol an appropriate diet for immune disorders? And the answer is yes, sometimes it's a really good idea. And how you know if it's a good idea is if a standard paleo diet is just not cutting it. So if you're following a standard paleo diet and doing like the squeaky clean version with, you know, eating, you know, high quality meats and vegetables and making sure you're getting some fish, and you're still having issues, then that's time to start looking at, maybe not the whole autoimmune protocol, but certainly elements of it. And the elements that I think are the most important, I think nightshades, number one, the most important thing to try eliminating if you are having issues with an immune system related disorder.
I just want to
jump in.
Yeah, you're probably going to reach across the states and smack me for saying this, but I have found that tomatoes and hot peppers are even worse for me than non-gluten containing grains. Like I can have non-gluten containing grains, specifically
like rice.
Yeah, white rice and sorghum. I'm not saying that I'm eating it all the time. I'm just like, if I go to the gluten-free bakery and I have a cookie that has non-gluten containing grains, I do not have the same inflammation, acne, migraine result that I get if I have even like a spoonful of tomatoes. So I just want to be very clear with people that this is not, see, we're not going to edit that out. This is not some, like hokey pokey thing that you're saying, like don't eat nightshades, because I heard that for a long time and I was like, I love tomatoes. There is no way I'm going to give up tomatoes. And what I have found is that, like Friday night I had a curry. And I had been, I'm not going to lie, like my family is going through a trauma right now and I've been eating things that I shouldn't be eating. And I wasn't having acne and I wasn't having half the problems that eating that bowl of curry with hot peppers in it. It was a coconut milk curry. It was perfectly paleo. Like by definition, that curry was paleo. But because it had hot peppers in it, I got big trouble the following day. So I want to kind of emphasize that for those of us with immune and autoimmune conditions, I think it's interesting you described it once as like tomatoes having, was it capsaicin, is an actual thing that they put in vaccines to inflame.
Yeah, it's actually, there's a glycoalkaloid in tomatoes called alpha-tomatine, which has been, it turns out it hasn't actually been used in broadly used vaccines. It's been used in some clinical trials for vaccines, and they've actually discovered that there may be some issues to using alpha-tomatine as an adjuvant. I just finished writing, my entire section for the book on exactly how all of these substances that are restricted on the autoimmune disease, and specifically grains, legumes, pseudograins, and nightshades, that kind of all go into one. Nightshades goes into the same category as those foods, and how they cross the lining of the gut and typically cause a leaky gut on their way out, and how they interact with the immune system. And I have a post on why nightshades are excluded in the autoimmune disease, and that's like absolutely completely relevant to immune disorders. It's basically because there's a type of saponin in nightshades that are called, it's as a class, they're called glycoalkaloids. And they are incredibly good at getting out of the gut and into the bloodstream, and they are incredibly good at stimulating the immune system. So those are definitely bad if you have diseases where your immune system is not working properly, whether it's autoimmune or just immune. I mean, those immune disorders can be just as serious as autoimmune disorders. So I don't want to say just immune disorders. But definitely, if you are following a standard paleo diet and you are having issues, nightshades are absolutely the next thing to look at. After that, if you are still having issues, evaluating the other foods that are restricted on the autoimmune protocol, eggs would probably be my next target. Unless you're drinking copious amounts of booze, then that would be a... If you're drinking a lot of booze.
So if you're Stacy and you're boozing it up and you're eating greens and you're eating curry, you're going to have problems.
Sadly. That basically is my summary of immune versus autoimmune, and can autoimmune protocol help immune disorders? The answer is yes, but you don't necessarily need to jump in with both feet. You can tackle it. If you're dealing with an immune condition, you can sort of tackle it in pieces, with nightshades being for sure the first piece to tackle. Does that make sense?
Yep. And I would say that that's consistent with our other discussions on autoimmune protocol reintroduction of foods. Like, you're basically saying last foods on the reintroduction of the autoimmune protocol are basically the...
Or nightshades, yeah. Especially tomatoes.
Yeah. So I think that's a consistent logical discussion we're having there.
Yes.
Shouldn't confuse too many people, but I'm sure we'll get a few emails.
Well, hopefully we can link to some more informative posts, and that will help people understand what the heck it was we just said.
Cool.
So questions?
Sounds good.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope.
So because we're talking about the immune system, I pulled out some questions that kind of covered the whole gamut. And the first question I pulled out of our queue was actually one regarding the flu, which I thought was sort of a very interesting, talk about infectious diseases part of the immune system as a good place to start. So this question was from Becca, and she wrote to me after we were having flu over Thanksgiving. So it's not the most recent question, but it's still topical because it's still flu season. I am also recovering from the flu that hit me over Thanksgiving. I would love a podcast discussion on this topic, healing your body after an illness. I was told over and over to drink Gatorade and start on the BRAT diet, bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast. But I am paleo and trying hard to stick to this lifestyle, so I struggled when my body was ready for food. Also was wondering about gentle supplements that might help recovery. So, should we talk the paleo version of the BRAT diet?
I feel like, are you sure we didn't answer this question before? Have I just read it before?
I've been asked this question many times.
Maybe that's why. Maybe it sounds so familiar to me. Yes, I also get this question a lot. And I've had a draft pending in my response post for I don't know, since before I started Beyond Vegan on how to respond to this. The reason that I think people believe that those foods are helpful is because they're bland, but there's plenty of bland, nutrient-dense foods that won't irritate your gut. Bananas aren't bad. Applesauce isn't bad, but obviously rice and toast are going to mess with your digestive tract, and if you've got the flu, the last thing you want to do is mess with your digestive tract. So what I would say in lieu of those things are, if you really want something bready, I enjoy almond flour muffins or coconut flour muffins, or we have a recipe for coconut macaroons on our website. Those things are really comforting to me if I want something bready when I'm sick. But I try to focus on re-inoculation, which we've talked a lot about on the podcast before, with broth and high-fat foods, so that it's easier to digest and, in general, feels better for me, and fermented foods. And I'm sure you'll talk about your favorite two topics that are not food related. I can always count on you.
To what, bring up sleep?
Yep.
What's the
sleep and
one?
Sunlight.
sleep and sun. I was going to, I've been trying to play with like the foods that are like the best starting foods, like especially after having like a stomach bug. And I've been trying to play with like a catchy, acronym that might, and I've got nothing.
You're trying to start something
like
best-selling book by
a new
calling
brat,
it,
but not. Brat.
Well, okay. Well, let's not reveal it now. Let's collaborate together and make $1 million selling some crazy fad diet.
That's
book.
Right.
Because all we that need is an acronym, and then we're good to go.
That could be the next book. But basically, I would say the very very first food that you should be trying after getting over like a stomach bug should be broth. After broth, something like, you know, again, bananas or applesauces, there's nothing wrong with that, but I would go from broth to like a brothy soup with some well-cooked vegetables and maybe a little bit of, well-cooked meat in it. That would sort of be like the next thing to try.
Like pre-digested food.
Yes. With a very sensitive, stomach. And then I would, you know, go from there. When I had the stomach flu in November, all I ate for about 24 hours after I started even wanting anything was broth. And then the next thing I had after broth was some like roasted chicken and some steamed vegetables. Like it was, you know, fairly benign food. And it was like the most awesome thing I'd ever eaten at that point. And then once things are going, you know, your digestion is going better, you know, basically tackle your normal foods, but just, you know, eat slow, chew your food, keep your portion sizes on the small side, give yourself time after you eat to make sure you're holding it down. And then yeah, fermented foods. Right. And then sleep and sunlight. And stress management and all those important lifestyle things.
Yeah, I found that the kids really like pancakes. And we have a recipe on our site for pancakes and like chicken breasts. Our family almost never eats chicken breasts. Like we prefer the thighs and legs. So if we buy parts, we always buy thighs and legs. And if we usually we'll make a whole chicken and we use the breast for like chicken salad after because no. Nobody really wants it. But I do find that when I'm kind of coming out of a food coma, that chicken breast in a broth with pre-digested vegetables, as I like to call them, is good. I mean, it's something that I tolerate well. So, cool. Wow, we're just scooching right along. It's awesome.
Oh, but the bonus section today is going to be long.
Uh-oh. Bonus section.
Bonus! We'll get there. We'll get there. We'll just leave that teaser out in the air. So question two is from Robbie from Wheat Ridge, Colorado. That's an unfortunately named town or city.
Don't make fun of Robbie's city now.
I'm sorry. It has wheat in the name. Maybe they could rename it. Something.
Robbie, you can continue to live in your city. Don't listen to Sarah. It's fine.
I'm sorry if I just offended a city. No, I've totally lost my train of thought. Okay. So Robbie writes, Stacey and Sarah, I'm a big fan of the podcast and I have experienced literally breathtaking results in just 2 weeks on the autoimmune protocol. I've regained my long lost sense of smell, which was overwhelming at first, but now has me sticking my nose in every spice shop I can get to. And we should point out that Robbie's loss of smell was an immune-related loss of smell rather than an autoimmune-related loss of smell. I've also gained some serious lung function since cold, dry air is kryptonite to an asthmatic, and I can now speedwalk in it with no premedication and no coughing.
Woot, woot.
That's awesome, isn't it? However, I am digging my way out of deep debt and have had to adapt the paleo template to suit my finances. I at least eat wild-caught salmon and bison several times a week and organic veggies when I can afford them, but other elements are not affordable to me right now. I will never willingly go back to eating grains, beans, or dairy now, and sticking to the autoimmune protocol is still effortless since I've had such amazing results in such a short period of time. My question is, would it be worth it to remind your listeners that leaning toward paleo can be just as important as the eventual inclusion of grass-fed butter and other more expensive foods? From my viewpoint, even mostly paleo definitely seems to be worth it. Thanks so much for all you do. So the reason why I included this question, besides the fact that it's a very interesting discussion topic for us, was partly to sort of reinforce that this is a person who had serious health issues from asthma, which is an immune condition, not an autoimmune condition, and who found really fantastic success and healing with the autoimmune protocol. So just, you know, throwing that out there. But to get to the meat of the question.
So I think it's a really good point, and I try to talk about this on my site as much as I can. I will admit, however, that it is difficult for Matt and I to remember, first of all, what it's like to start paleo, because it's been almost 3 years for us now. And also, you know, we're fortunate financially in that we don't have to be as careful as we were when we started. So, you know, over the course of 3 years, we have moved to making a commitment to spending our money on sustainably and humanely raised meat. That wasn't something we could afford originally. And so, great point. What is interesting, and I'll ask Matt to put a couple of links in the show notes. I know that Summer from Dirty Floor Diaries, and I think it's the Paleo Mama, are both blogging right now really awesome posts about where they're shopping and where they're finding good deals. We actually did that, if you look back on our site, like 3 years ago, but it's not going to be really timely and relevant, I'm sure, to what you can now get at Costco or what you now can get at Walmart or whatever it is. But Summer actually does affordable meal planning. So she'll put out like 5 dinners and 3 snack recipes, and she'll say, okay, and we're just going to eat eggs for breakfast. And here's how much it's costing. I think she's got like 5 people in her family. So it's like big meals that she's making really affordably on a really tight budget. And it's just exactly what Robbie's talking about here. I know Rob Wolf also did a post on focusing on, you know, getting 80 to 90% of the way in terms of removing grains, removing beans, and removing low quality dairy, and then worry about grass fed, and then worry about organic. But the most important, like 80 to 90% of the benefit is going to come from just removing those things and not adding back in, okay, now I'm going to do grass fed, now I'm going to do that kind of stuff. So
yeah, I think a lot of people are under the, what I think is really sort of a misnomer, that the only way to do paleo is if you're eating, you know, completely grass-fed meat and completely organic vegetables that are locally grown. And I mean, that's the ideal and that's a great goal, but it's just not feasible for
most people, even Matt and I, like that, it just doesn't happen. You know what I mean? Like sometimes we just go to the store and we want raspberries and it's there and it's not organic and the world doesn't stop because we bought non-organic raspberries.
Yeah,
and
like, I still can't afford to eat 100% organic and 100% you know, grass-fed.
If anybody is telling you that they're eating 100% grass-fed and 100% locally grown organic produce, they're lying to you, because there's absolutely no way to live this life in a normal way. You know, we talked last week with Mark about practical application of this stuff and figuring out how to do it in the modern world. Like, just do the best you can. I would say, we've talked about it before, making paleo affordable, focus on the fattier cuts being grass-fed organic if you can, pasture-raised. The fat is where the toxins are going to build up. So if you're going to buy, you know, a pot roast, or you're going to buy some of the more braised-type meat, they're actually cheaper. So I would focus on, if you're going to do a split, those being your you're grass-fed pastured. If you can't do that, it's fine. You know, just do the best you can. And then supplement more with vegetables that are affordable. Cabbage, carrots, and onions are supremely cheap. And we have them almost every day just because they keep really well in the fridge. They go with almost everything. The kids love them. And they're totally affordable. So, you know, find the vegetables in your family that you think, and cauliflower is another one that is almost always.
And we've been doing a lot of squash, which is also, I think, very affordable. Mm-hmm. And sweet potatoes, if you know your prices, they can be very cheap. You kind of have to know your prices because they're one of those things that you'll see for like 80 cents a pound. And then in the next store, you'll see for $3 a pound.
Yeah.
And kind of like...
It's definitely worth a weekend to walk around, drive around, whatever, to your local grocery stores and figure out who has the best prices on what. I mean, you can try to do research online, but ultimately, I know for me personally, the cheapest grocery stores around here are the Asian food markets, and they've got phenomenal quality produce at super cheap rock bottom prices. I don't know what they're doing. I think they're like growing them in the back. It's insane how affordable and high quality.
Maybe it just tells you what the markup is.
Yeah, at the big chain stores, right. So no one is going to tell you online, go to your local Asian food market to find Japanese sweet potatoes for 40 cents a pound, or, you know, like whatever insane thing it is that I'm able to find there. But take one weekend, go around with a list of your most frequently bought items, top 20, top 50, I don't care. And write the price down of every single one of those items at the three or four different stores that you typically shop at, and then total what the underlying is. If you're able to shop at one or two stores, strategically choose those things. Or if you're stuck for time and you only do shopping once a week, then say, this is the store that I know bottom line, I'm usually going to get the best bang for my buck. So this is where I'm going to choose to shop, whether that's Trader Joe's or Costco or the Asian food market. Or I know like Walmart and Target now have full grocery stores in a lot of their locations that people are reporting now carry grass-fed meat really affordably. If that's an option for you, go for it and don't worry. You know, it's just, I think it's a really good point. I'll ask Matt to also put in the show notes Balanced Bites post on paleo perfectionism. And part of the reason, Sarah, that you and I get along really well is because we know that people are doing this in a real world environment with families, and the paleo perfectionist approach is not going to be successful for most people. It's not something I endorse or support or recommend, because I think most people end up rebounding on the back of paleo perfectionism. So.
Yeah. There's like a rebellion almost, whether it's subconscious or conscious at the other end. Budget's a whole topic, and I think, I mean, not that I want to get into this necessarily right now, but one of the best ways to save money is to do more work yourself. But then, of course, for a lot of people, the time commitment that takes is no longer reasonable. So for a lot of people, there's sort of a balance between, okay, so what can I pay a little bit more for because somebody already, you know, chopped those vegetables or cut that meat into cubes versus, you know, what is worth my time to do for the amount of money that I'll save. And that's, you know, that's going to depend on the individual and what their comfort level is in the kitchen and exactly what kind of foods that you're talking about and what the price differences are. But there's sort of that also, that extra, balance between, like, generally you can do paleo very inexpensively if you're okay with putting the time into food prep. Just throwing that out there.
Shizzle dizzle.
Did you just become Diane for a second?
I don't know. I'm starting to.
You've been listening.
I don't know what the special thing is you've got planned at the end, but I'm probably going to be insane by the time we get there.
Well, then I guess we better go to the next question. So our next question I thought was a very interesting one to talk about. And it's a question from Jesse. And Jesse writes, I'm HIV positive, and other than weight issues, morbidly obese, I'm pretty healthy. I was wondering, how would I go about slowly changing my eating habits to paleo, and do you think it would help me HIV-wise? Also, I have a soon-to-be 7-year-old little girl who is having weight issues. Would there be different recipes/guidelines for paleo children?
So this is a question I've been looking forward to answering. I don't have... I'm looking forward to hearing your scientific approach to it. But I ended up emailing with Jessie because I was so moved by her looking into how to help both herself and her daughter. So what I recommended is that, they both try to move towards a transition of paleo, and that absolutely it would be great for her daughter as well. For both, overall health as well as then naturally children tend to lean out. I don't want to say that they lose weight, but they lean out going paleo. And so with less highly processed, palatable foods, they're more likely to eat reasonable portions and control their cravings by having normal, healthy food. I mean, people come into my house and they see the kids begging for cranberries or larabars, and we're like, no, you have to wait until after you've eaten your meal for a treat. And they're like, that's a treat? And I'm like, of course that's a treat, So for someone starting, it's going to be a lot different than that. But those less palatable foods can be something that you can give your child without concern, a larabar, homemade or not, or, fresh fruit, or we've talked before about switching from gummy snacks to dried fruit. And so that you're less concerned about the amount of processed chemicals going into the family's life. And Sarah and I also really highly endorse kind of a phased approach to paleo to people who are intimidated by starting. So if you feel more comfortable transitioning to paleo, then by all means transition to paleo. Sarah and I each kind of jumped in head first and then had our families trail on in a transition, and it worked well for us. Everybody's family is different though. So no matter what, I would definitely start by removing gluten and high fructose corn syrup from the diet. That's what I did. Those are my absolute rules starting out. And we've removed gluten and high fructose containing foods from our pantry. And then we ate our way through the rest of it that was there. And then as it left, like let's say gummy snacks left, then in came dried fruit and trail mix mixtures and stuff like that. So that it wasn't like all at once where the kids were overwhelmed by this is all new food. It was, okay, well, when your Gorilla Munch cereal is gone, we're not going to buy any more cereal. So you can choose something else at the store that you would like to have for breakfast. What would you like to choose that is on this list of things that I've helped? And whether that's, the grain-free granola cereal recipe from us, or if that's Sarah's granola bars or muffins from our websites, or, whatever it is, that will I think that's a great way to transition. So do you want to talk about the immune situation?
Yeah. So this is actually a topic that I spent some time researching for some other questions that I had. So I can say that the amount of information out there about diet and HIV is fairly minimal, but what there is information on is that the importance of micronutrient sufficiency. So it seems really, really important to have a sort of ample supply of all of the micronutrients. And when you look at micronutrients, basically every single micronutrient has a role in the immune system. Some of the most important micronutrients in terms of the immune system are all of the fat-soluble vitamins. Zinc is incredibly important. Magnesium is really important. Iron, copper. I'm just going to start listing like every single vitamin and mineral here. Antioxidants. So what I would recommend transitioning to, and whether or not you want to jump in with both feet or if you want to take this in pieces is totally what, you know, what you think is going to work best for you. But where I think the best place to end up would be is in a very micronutrient density focused version of a paleo diet. So that really means something very close to the autoimmune protocol. I definitely, we've already talked about nightshades, and I would definitely recommend getting to paleo without nightshades. But then a really strong focus on getting some quality animal fats, animal fats or fats from animals that are grass-fed or pastured are going to have the highest density of fat-soluble vitamins in them. And, you know, just to touch on the previous question about budget, my butcher at my local Whole Foods will give me the fat trimmings off his grass-fed meat for free if I call ahead on the day that they get their grass-fed meat delivery and ask them to put those aside. So, so if, you know, there are sort of ways of getting those really, really high quality fats very inexpensively. That was free. I just had to render it myself. And then I would really have a focus on, antioxidants. So really making sure that I was eating a lot of, plant material, a lot of vegetables, especially non-starchy vegetables. Whether or not you want to do that with something like vegetable juices, I know that that is a way that a lot of people tackle immune disorders to get that really dense, really highly absorbable antioxidants and it also very rich in vitamins and minerals. It takes out the fiber, so it's actually a little bit more absorbable. You just have to be aware that that's a bit of a sugar kick, and that might be hard on your body given a history with obesity. So, so however you choose to get your vegetables, making sure that you're eating tons of them. And the other thing is there is actually some evidence in the medical literature that coconut oil may help reduce HIV viral load. So like the two things that are there's medical literature to support is a diet rich in antioxidants can reduce HIV viral load, and a diet that includes coconut oil can help reduce HIV viral load. So I would get some really good quality coconut oil and start getting used to cooking with it. And just replace all of your cooking oils with coconut oil. I will take a spoon of coconut oil, like, and I'll just eat it off the spoon. And that's like totally a place that you could go, and a surprisingly large number of paleo people do that.
Well, to be clear, you can also find coconut oil and coconut fats in a lot of coconut products.
That's
so
true.
You know, if you want to eat coconut flakes, if you're not, I don't like spoonfuls of coconut and I can't eat them. I can't eat it like that because I don't have a gallbladder anyway. But, the caramelized coconut chips that we've talked about before from the Clothes Make the Girl is a really good way to get in coconut and coconut oil and fats.
Coconut milk is delicious.
Yep.
Just put it in a bowl with some berries or something like that.
It's coconut
like
cream concentrate, coconut manna, coconut butter are really good in, you know, teas and coffees, and you can bake with them. There's a lot of recipes around using coconut flour, coconut cream concentrate to get that in if you're not quite ready to eat spoonfuls of it. Although, again, it is work. And, you know, when you start adding snacks and baked goods to your paleo template, you're not helping with your weight loss, and it's also adding to the budget. So you have to balance that.
So hopefully that helps. That actually brings us to the end of our questions for today.
I just want to point out that if it weren't for this thing that you've got planned, we would have finished a show in under an hour.
Yeah, but I wouldn't. I would have put in more questions.
You're like, I would have been entirely dissatisfied.
Yeah. Do you know our show 2 weeks ago that was like the 2 hour long best of show?
Best of.
I had somebody actually email me and say that she wished that every show was 2 hours long.
Oh my gosh. You've just got like compliment hoarders on your site.
I encourage them. I pay them mostly. Yes.
Okay.
So are we ready for an actual bonus segment? A paleo parenting segment?
Bonus.
That's like my total surprise. We're doing a paleo parenting segment this week.
Shocking.
Woohoo! Eat like a dinosaur. Hit my plate and hear me
roar. I eat like a dinosaur. Segment this week, paleo parenting.
So our paleo parenting segment for today is actually not really directly related to our theme topic, but it's more related to current events topics. I've received a lot of questions in the last 2 weeks or so about basically whether or not it's better to introduce a little bit of gluten into our children's diets. And I think where this question is coming from is a study that was just published online ahead of the paper print from the journal Pediatrics that looked at a bunch of Swedish children, a group that were born during a celiac disease outbreak and a group that were born after, and tried to tease out what was different between the kids who were born during the outbreak and the kids who were born after. And one of the conclusions that this paper draws is that introducing gluten before weaning seemed to protect these kids against developing celiac disease. And I actually published a post on my blog today that was discussing this paper and discussing, you know, whether or not the results actually proved that conclusion, which I don't believe they do. But it became such a hot topic that I ended up pulling together a few questions that are sort of related to that we could talk about. So maybe the most direct question that I've received the most frequently is if giving my baby some gluten before weaning may give them immune tolerance against gluten, should I introduce some gluten to my paleo baby while they're still breastfeeding so that they can develop this immune tolerance to gluten? My answer is it's complicated. This paper shows that the longer you breastfeed, the lower your risk of celiac disease. And that can be added to the plethora of papers showing the longer you breastfeed, the lower your risk of, X. And the thought behind the reason why it might be that introducing gluten while still breastfeeding may protect the baby is because of the components of breast milk, and specifically because when you're breastfeeding your baby, they're getting probiotics in the breast milk, and these probiotics may be helping to modulate the immune reaction to consuming gluten. So Stacey, I don't know if you have any really strong opinions here. I basically came up with the science does not say that it's better to introduce gluten earlier so that your baby can develop gluten tolerance, or B, that introducing gluten later in life is going to increase risk of celiac disease. What it does say is having a healthy gut is really important. And I think that you can say that gluten is not conducive to a healthy gut. I also, want to point out that I'm not quite sure what the benefits of immune tolerance against gluten actually are. The long-term health effects of a diet that contain gluten are becoming more and more apparent. So developing an immune tolerance against gluten may just be opening up a person to having issues later in life rather than earlier in life. So I think there's a lot to talk about here. And I've tried to sort of address most of this in my post today. And that's about as far as I'm going to basically end with saying, it's not clear whether or not there's a benefit to doing that in the literature. My feeling on the matter is that gluten is not nutritious in any way, and that there is certainly no compelling evidence that introducing gluten early in life can protect against anything. The evidence really is that breastfeeding is good.
So I took two things away from when I read it. One, that they didn't maintain the variables be consistent. And anytime that you have a study that has multiple variables changing, you can't say, which I know you're alluding to, but I didn't hear you specifically call out the fact that the variables weren't consistent. Therefore, you can't say that the result is because of the introduction of gluten, because other variables changed in the study as well. For example, longer breastfeeding times, which anybody who's listened to me talk before, you can already tell I'm getting like anger in my voice. I'm extremely passionate about breastfeeding. We have a whole show on it and the importance of maintaining a healthy, exclusively breastfed gut for as long as you are possibly able gives your children the best health benefit by every single study ever done. There has never been a single study that's come out that said it's good to breastfeed for less amount of time. I'm sure somebody will find some article that some crazy person wrote, like the China study, and pull that on me, but whatever, I don't care. I'm going to make that bold statement. And the second thing that I took away from, the second thing that I took away from that, is that, the study is just like the studies that came out, I don't know, 6 to 12 months ago, where it was like 1 month, introduce peanuts to your babies so that they don't get peanut allergies later in life. And then the doctors turned around a couple months later and were like, no, we're completely wrong on that. Now we believe something else. And it's like, you know what? Does your baby need peanuts? No? Okay, then don't do it. Like, does your baby need gluten? No, then don't do it. I mean, fortified rice cereal has some benefits if you're not breastfeeding your baby, because iron supplies, iron stores do deplete more rapidly in non-breastfed babies than breastfed babies. So there could be an argument to be made. But then again, Sarah and I would say, well, then give your child liver, because that's mm-hmm. the most iron dense,
and more absorbable,
easily absorbable,
easier to digest.
Exactly. However, I can at least understand where someone is coming from in saying that rice cereal, because it's fortified with iron, is what my pediatrician's always told me is why babies need that. There is no reason, absolutely no reason, that I am aware of, or I'm sure Sarah can speak for you and say you're aware of, that any child would ever need any gluten-containing food. None.
I would generalize that to saying any person.
Any person ever, right. But what I'm specifically addressing, though, is like, why would we need to introduce gluten if we're believers in gluten-free and paleo in general? Then we hope that our children and our families choose to live this lifestyle for optimizing their own health for a lifetime. Therefore, the longer they never have gluten, the better it is. And it's like, if they end up being celiac, but they've never had gluten, then so what? Like, they don't have the negative benefits.
You can't become celiac.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what I'm saying? Like, if they would have been celiac, but they never had gluten except, like, you know, three random accidental exposures in your lifetime, because most people will accidentally be exposed to gluten at some point in their life. But, like, if that's it, then you've done the best by them anyway. I think the much worse thing, if for me personally, I you know, if I could go back in time and as an infant tell my mom, like, don't give me the gluten, like, I would much rather, you know, have never had it, and then if I did accidentally have it, have like a violent, gut-wrenching, vomiting kind of reaction, but that's it, and I didn't have a lifetime of autoimmune disorder turmoil in my body because I had been exposed to it my whole life. Like, to me, that's not even a discussion. And I'm like, well, clearly I choose the option where three times I vomit instead of my entire life is filled with illness, you know?
Well, and there really is not very compelling evidence to show that delaying introduction changes whether or not you have a reaction. It seems to be much more reliant on the health of the gut. So if you have a healthy gut, whenever you get that accidental exposure as a child growing up paleo, if you have a healthy gut, then chances are very good that you're going to handle it and be fine. This is an excellent segue into the next, a question that was actually submitted to the podcast that is a question that I've received in various forms. It's a question from Veronica from Golden Valley, Minnesota. And she is a stay-at-home mom. And what is with two kids. And when she travels home to her home country, I don't know where her home country is, it's impossible to stay away from gluten. And there's just not as many gluten-free resources in her home country as there are here. And so she writes, am I doing more harm than good if I eliminate gluten completely? Should I keep some gluten in her diet, in her daughter's diet, so she doesn't react too strongly when she consumes it? Birthday parties, travel home, etc. I know that the line of reasoning of my question is very faulty. Should I keep giving my daughter something that is bad for her so it won't be so bad when she eats it occasionally? But it's been a concern of mine in going 100% gluten-free. Also, I suspect that gluten in small amounts doesn't seem to affect her behavior. It seems to be worse when she consumes it many days in a row, like on vacation or holidays. Thank you, and I love your podcast.
So can we acknowledge that Veronica has answered her own question? One, she says that she knows that it's faulty. And two, she says that her daughter has behavioral problems when she eats it many days in a row, which means it's building up in her system and causing problems. Like, I just, again, it seems pretty obvious to me because my, okay, so let me try to get off my soapbox a little bit here. My middle child probably has celiac disease. It runs in our family. He has the exact same genetic makeup as me. He's the only child in the family that even remotely looks like me. He's got the same skin problems as me. He gets high fevers the way I used to when I was a kid. His immune system is clearly built very similar to mine.
He does look like a mini you.
Thank you. Isn't he so cute? Not that I think I'm cute, but
all three of your
so
boys
cute.
Are adorable.
Thank
but,
you.
Yeah, no, he is. He's like a mini you.
Yeah. So he's like my genetic mini me. And it is the farthest thing that I would ever do to regularly expose him to gluten so that when he has it at grandpa's house accidentally, or when he has it because he sneaks food at a birthday party and is eating goldfish under the table or like whatever it is that happens, that then he doesn't get violently ill from that. And instead he maintains a regular amount of sickness his whole life. Like that to me, again, just seems like if those are my two choices, and I don't know that there's a different choice than those two, hands down, I would never choose to have my child regularly be ill, which is what you're choosing. If you know that your child is responding at all to gluten, and clearly Veronica knows that her child is responding to gluten, then by keeping it in her diet at all is causing more harm than good.
Yeah, I think that part of this type of question comes from discussions that Rob Wolf has had many times on his podcast about military personnel who have the high possibility of being deployed. And when they're deployed, they don't have any control over their food. And, you know, he typically recommends that these people continue to consume some gluten so that they maintain some of the body's natural defense mechanisms against gluten so that they don't have violent reactions to gluten when they have to eat it, when, you know, wherever they end up being sent. I think the question is really different when you're talking about a growing child. And you're talking about situations where even if there's fewer resources, that doesn't mean that there's not zero resources. I mean, you still do have some choice. Most countries, you can bring some non-perishable foods across borders. So you could, at the very least, be bringing some, you know, some nuts or some, you might even be able to bring some
beef jerky,
some beef jerky or some nut flours or something to do baking on the other end. I mean, I'm assuming since you're going to your home country that you're going to visit your family, because, I mean, I would assume that because that's my situation. There, you know, for most countries, you can bring non-perishable food across a border. You could bring some Larabars, you know, you could pack at least part of a suitcase with some resources to bring with you. So it may just require a shift in thinking from what can I do to protect my child when they eat a ton of gluten when I go home for a visit, to what can I do to protect my child from eating a ton of gluten when we go home to visit. So instead of thinking about maintaining some kind of, you know, thicker mucus layer in their small intestines by giving them gluten twice a week, now think of ways that you can minimize their exposure to gluten when you travel, or ways that you can minimize exposure when you go to birthday parties. We went to 2 birthday parties on Saturday, which, by the way, 2 birthday parties in one day is like really a lot. I just want to, wow. Yay me for taking both my girls to 2 birthday parties. I made paleo cookies for my kids that morning, and we showed up to both birthday parties with our own treats. And so my kids were just so happy to be able to play at these birthday parties. And then when the cake came out, they ate the treats that I brought instead of the cake that was full of, you know, all the normal things that cake is full of. So, you know, part of the
reason that that's successful for you is because you've set that expectation with your mm-hmm. girls, and you've established the rules, and they know what to expect and what's allowed and what's not allowed. You know, what I noticed from this question is she says, how do I recover in situations that I can't avoid, in parentheses, she lists birthday parties. Like, I would argue that it's easily avoidable at a birthday party if you've planned ahead and established guidelines with your children. Just like my children are not allowed to play in the street without an adult, they're not allowed to eat gluten. Like,
and she's talking about a 2.5-year-old daughter here. And the way that I talk to my 6-year-old is very different from the way that I talk to my 3-year-old. My 3-year-old does not understand this food has gluten, this food doesn't. It's not as easy with that sort of terrible to sort of age child, and I get that. The words that I use is, you know, no, sweetheart, that food's going to hurt your tummy. And she will say, why is that food going to hurt my tummy? And I'll say, because your tummy doesn't like that food. And those kinds of words really help her. I have to have something to give her instead. It doesn't work if I don't have something to give her instead. But she, you know, she kind of, I mean, I think she understands because those foods do hurt her tummy. I think that she understands. With my older daughter who's 6, I can have a discussion about, you know, what the function of gluten is in the plant. She doesn't fall far from the tree there. She's a big nerd. So I can actually have discussions with her about what the function of gluten is in the plant and why it's not good in our digestive tracts. But the discussion at a 6-year-old level is quite different. But with my, you know, 3-year-old, and we figured out that she was gluten intolerant shortly after she turned 2. So, you know, it's very similar age. That's the discussion. You know, you can't eat that food because it hurts your tummy. Redirect. Let's focus on this other food that we can eat. So the second birthday party we were at had pizza. You can't eat that food because it hurts your tummy. But hey, look, they've got watermelon. So why don't you have a big plate of watermelon? And she was quite happy to eat a huge plate of watermelon. So, I think part of this question is, I think she's asking us for priorities, which I think we've already shared ours. And I think that might help her maybe now go away and sort of figure out strategies. And that's going to be, yeah, strategies are always something that's very personal. Are we done?
I was just going to...
You're going to get on your soapbox again?
No. I've relaxed. Okay. I would say that the other component of this that we haven't really addressed yet is the identification of foods that would be naturally non-glutinous in other countries. Like, I understand that, you know, if she's going to some sort of Nova Scotia land. Listen, Matt is literally laughing right now as he edits this because he knows exactly that, like, I'm thinking of places where, what's the group of countries that's like Sweden where they just eat white food all the time? What do they call that? They call it something.
Are you thinking like Scandinavia?
Yeah. That's okay. Totally almost Nova Scotia.
Nova Scotia, Scandinavia. So Nova Scotia is a maritime province in Canada. It's on a different continent.
All right, listen, let's not belabor my idiocracy. Okay. What I'm trying, I've established that I don't know
Nova Scotia. It's a very great province.
Okay. What I meant was Scandinavia, if her native country is a Scandinavian country, I understand that it's going to have mashed potatoes and, you know, maybe all the meat normally comes breaded. However, almost any ethnic food restaurant that I go to, because I live in Northern Virginia, where we are graced with ethnic restaurants from around the world, every single one that I go to, I am able to find something on the menu that is naturally gluten-free. You know, whether it's a roast chicken or a steak or a salad, like you don't, you know, if you're not able to find salad dressings that are made with nothing but balsamic and olive oil, and that's not something that you either are comfortable asking for or know how to ask for, or you think they wouldn't have, like, okay, fine, then prioritize that you're not going to have the best quality oil, but at least try to remove gluten from a rotation. Don't just enter a country and say, throw up your hands and say, it's hard to eat gluten-free here, I'm not going to. You know, Italy, which is the Americans think of as the most glutinous country, is actually extremely accommodating with gluten-free. And even I've heard grain-free, you know, coming up and helping you figure out dishes that are natural, traditional Italian dishes lacking pasta and bread. Those things exist. You just have to think outside your box and, you know, order a bunless burger, order whatever. I mean, I butter chicken, you know, it's difficult for me at an Indian restaurant because, you know, I'm dairy-free, I'm legume-free, I'm grain-free, and almost everything is, like, vegetarian with cheese, right? I have friends who love Indian food, and I end up eating buttered chicken. Is it something that I would normally eat? No. Does it have more dairy than I'd like? Yes. However, is it grain-free? Yes. Do I get to go to a restaurant that my friends enjoy going to and eat something that doesn't make me sick? Yes. You know, figure out something. Ask what's in things and come up with foods that are naturally non-glutinous. And I feel like it's a mindset thing. Like, you have to tell yourself, I don't eat gluten. And then you find ways around it. If you don't tell yourself that and you're like, oh, this is hard, so I'm going to eat this thing, then it's a snowball. We've talked about that snowball. Like, once you have one thing, then it's a road to, you know, gluten. That's my HE double hockey stick anyway. So I'm like, that's where you're going with that. Yeah.
All right.
It's the same thing with sugar. Yeah. I have that, you know. Anyway.
Okay.
Was that I totally got, I could feel my blood pressure is different. I got back on a soapbox. I have to calm down again.
It was all good. There's one more question that I pulled out of our queue that I think is really relevant to this whole, like, should we give our kids gluten topic? And it's a question from Riley from Altoona, Iowa. I have ulcerative colitis and my wife does not. She is 1 month pregnant and eating about 70% paleo and 95% gluten-free. She started this lifestyle because of me, but doesn't really know the science behind it. She worries that eating gluten-free will make the baby allergic to gluten later in life. I am not worried about it because I will teach it what foods are good, but she doesn't want to make that decision for our future children. What do you girls think? Keep up the awesome podcast.
I think it's your wife's body, first of all. So try as you might, respect that your wife is creating a tiny human, and don't push too hard on that front. Are you nodding, Sarah?
Yeah. I am nodding.
Okay. Oh. I know if that was me and Matt was being a food pusher, it would honestly make me want to eat whatever he was saying not to eat.
And not to give pregnant women everywhere, like, the huge excuse, but hormones mess you up. And
that's coming from a scientist.
I'm a very stubborn person at the best of times, but I don't think I would have listened to somebody say something like that to me when I was pregnant. I would have said, but this is what I want to eat right now. And that would have been the end of the discussion. That being said, there really is not any good supportive science to show that avoiding a food while pregnant will cause a food sensitivity to that food. I mean, there's some interesting studies with, like, peanut allergies, but they aren't very well controlled variables. So, I would say that when it comes to the health of your baby, looking after gut health is the most important. No, it's not the most important thing. Loving your baby and cherishing your baby and providing a nice environment for your baby is the most important thing. But beyond that, in terms of food anyways, things that support gut health are what are going to support overall health. So that is things like, breastfeeding. That is things like your wife having a nutrient-dense diet while breastfeeding, and whether that includes the occasional bit of gluten or not, here's where we start talking about, 80-20 or 90-10 rules. And if she doesn't have a really strong medical history that would mean that she has to be gluten-free 100% of the time, and I personally think that gluten doesn't provide any particular nutrition, but there is definitely a small percentage of the population who really do not have any health issues with gluten. And so if she's one of those, lucky few, if she has a really, nutrient dense diet elsewhere and has the occasional gluten dose, then she's still going to be making really great quality breast milk for your baby. When it comes to, starting solids, there's, lots of great information on paleo parents about baby-led weaning. There's some information on my site about what good you know, vet foods make good baby foods when you are ready to go there. And at that point, focusing on paleo foods becomes, I think, more important, because it's really, it's not processed and filtered. It's like directly into your baby's digestive system. And so you have some time to work out with your wife what your food philosophy is between now and then. So I hope that sort of answers the question. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the most important thing for me is your wife seems to be supportive. Like, this is a problem for you and she's adopted it. Paleo 70% and is 95% gluten-free. You know, I'd like to see someone a little more 80 to 90% paleo and then 100% gluten-free. But considering that she's pregnant and she's doing it just to be supportive of you, it doesn't say how long she's been doing that, right? But like, it took Matt almost 6 months to be fully on board. Like, he was still drinking Monster drinks and Diet Coke and occasionally sneaking pizza and bread for a while when I had gone paleo in the beginning. And so he was probably about that same ratio. And now look where he is, you know?
It took my husband probably, I mean, in the beginning, he doesn't even remember saying this at this point, but in the beginning he was like, I'm not giving up my cereal for breakfast. Like, literally, he said that. He doesn't even remember. He's like, I never said that. I was supportive from the beginning. I'm like, yeah, right, sweetheart. Yeah,
yeah.
Totally. You know, and my husband's at the point now where he got glutened a few weeks ago and felt terrible for a few weeks. I was like, woohoo, you're officially paleo if being gluten makes you feel horrible. That's totally not a good note to end on. He had health issues that probably were linked to gluten beforehand, but it took him, it's more that it took him that long to actually get rid of, all gluten exposure. Like the first few times he went traveling after we were on paleo, he didn't worry about what he was eating at all. And then he kind of migrated to ordering a breakfast sandwich and then just peeling off the bread and eating the eggs in between, which you and I wouldn't do because it touched the bread. Like, it, you know, for us, that level of gluten exposure is too much. So it's for a lot of people, for a lot of spouses especially, it can be sort of a long process, and some never really you know, get enthusiastically behind it. Does that make sense?
Hopefully that's helpful. I would say, you know, we've answered specifically why the baby won't have problems with gluten just because she's not eating it when she's pregnant. So if that's the information she's looking for, you have that answer and links in this podcast. But I would say more, you know, understand and appreciate that when you're a pregnant woman, like, I had an entire pizza myself every Friday. Like, that was my thing when I was pregnant. So if your wife is 70% paleo and 95% gluten-free, if she can counter that with some nutrient-dense foods, like, if you're like, okay, if that's what you're going to do, but I would feel better if you had organ meat, fatty fish, and fermented foods a couple times a week, you know, find some balance. It doesn't sound to me like you're particularly concerned about the overall health and wellness of your baby, which I think is a good place to be. Don't stress her out. Stress on her system is way worse for the baby than 5% gluten, in my opinion, anyway. So, if she's not responsive to it. So, yeah. That's it. We did a bonus section.
We did. And it was a long one.
Yep. You said it would be.
I did. I wasn't lying. You know, we got to make our shows, you know, the length that people expect now.
Sure.
But we're done.
Okay.
Any last thoughts?
No, we'll be back. We'll be back next week with a special guest. So make sure you turn in. And if you didn't listen to our previous three shows, which are probably our, other than Stephanie Rupert, now I don't want to say that, but they were good shows. Make sure you don't miss the last three shows.
I we're like a wine and we get better with age or something. Something dorky. I'm just going to stop talking now. It could be the end of the show.
Okay. See you next week, everyone.
All right. Good night.
If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
I am a psycho multitasker.
Okay, yes, I'm trying to find bubbly.